This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 4, IDN Technical and Operations, held on the 23rd of February, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? And again, train, we have you listed as audio only. Anyone else in addition? Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Cheryl Langdon Orr. And on a side note, it looks like Rubens has just joined us on the Adobe Connect as well.
Excellent. Thank you, Terry. And perfect timing, Rubens. We're just getting the call started. So Terry's taken us through the general administrivia, but there is an additional piece of administrivia that we always like to look at, and that is asking, has anyone got an update to their statements of interest? So we'll do that now. Not hearing anybody saying that they do. I'll remind you that, of course, statements of interest do need to be updated under an expectation of continuous disclosure. So if your circumstances change, particularly those of an employment nature, you do need to update your statement of interest. And if you do not know how to do that, our friendly and amazing ICANN staff are always available to help. Rubens, you got a microphone connected? Terry, can you just make sure Rubens does have audio?
Certainly. And Rubens, I do see where your microphone is active, so you may want to check it on your side.
Otherwise, okay,
you can always send me a chat to dial out to you at a phone number.
Okay, tracking down on private chat, Terry, to see what we need to do. The next thing on our agenda is a full working group update, and that's going to fall to Avery, seeing as Jess isn't joining us today. So, Avery, if you would be so kind as to bring us up to speed with what the activities of the full working group is, and perhaps a little bit of preparatory planning for the Copenhagen meeting would be greatly appreciated. Our guest speaker is not with us yet, so there is no particular restriction on time. And I will note when Don joins the room. Over to you, Avery.
Okay, thanks. Keep Avery speaking. I don't have a whole lot to say. We're still gathering a set of authors for the 3CC1 tasks. I was just now looking for the list of names to see how we were doing, but I couldn't find it, so maybe like Steve or Emily could just dig that out and let me know how we're doing on it so that I can, you know, just get that said. The other thing we're doing is we're planning for a full meeting next Monday where we're going to do our first walkthrough of the questions that have been assembled by the four sub-teams for the CC2 questionnaire. So we'll do the first reading then. We'll see what we have to do to tighten them up, have a little bit of discussion on each one, and then deal with any comments we've got so that we can do a second reading and get that out before the meeting in Copenhagen. At the meeting in Copenhagen, we're basically going to use a lot of our time to talk about some of the questions that are there. It would be too much to try and talk about all of them. So what we've decided to do is to basically go through talking to you all in the groups, but also seeing which ones prompt the most interest, and perhaps even do a poll in our full meeting to determine which are the top three or four out of each group of questions to do some special focus on. The rest of the meeting, there'll be a little bit of review, a little bit of update to the community. and part of the pull on the meeting is to try and get as much community input into some of these discussions, going beyond the input that's been collected in starting to create the questions. We also have to do a certain amount to get the various constituencies, stakeholder groups, ACs, SOs that want to answer, interested enough to work through these questions, because that will be quite a challenge for them. So that's pretty much what I would report on. I don't know if Don is here yet, and I'm certainly willing to entertain any questions about what's going on, but otherwise, I'm ready to stop.
Thank you very much, Everett. Cheryl, for the record again. Do we have Rubens on audio yet?
And Charlotte, Terry, unfortunately where Rubens is at, the mobile coverage is very poor. So if you don't mind if we just take a moment, he's going to try to test his audio again quickly, his microphone.
Certainly, I think we should do that, particularly since Don hasn't joined us as yet, and I have just sent him a reminder email.
And Rubens, is here if you want to go ahead and try. Unfortunately, Rubens, we're still unable to hear you at this time.
Okay, Terry, it looks like the gremlins are abounding in today's plan, and I'm quite sure that as Don's last interchange with Steve and Rubens and myself indicated that he was hoping to be here actually closer to the top of the hour, that it is for, again, some unforeseen circumstance or complication that he has not been able to join the Adobe Connect room and the audio. If Steve happens to have a phone number for Don, I'm afraid I've just looked and I don't. If he does have such a thing, then perhaps he could pass it to you, Terry, and you could try dialing out to him. So that leaves us then with the presentation that had been sent forward regarding an introduction to universal acceptance. And I would like to think that if Don does join us in the next few minutes, he can take us through that. But let's start a general discussion on UA, universal acceptance, and why indeed our work team 4 needs to be bothered with it in any way, shape or form. Well, the answer to the second part of that question is that, of course, we have a mandate to do so. It is one of the issues that we need to look at, but it also is linked with that mandate that we need to recognise that the universal acceptance study group is active and that we don't need to duplicate any efforts. So if and when Don joins us, we'll be able to head into that presentation. But that's why we're holding out to do that. Rubens has quite sensibly suggested we look at our 52 questions while he tries and, I guess, you know, stand on a ladder and hold his arm in the air to get more mobile coverage. So if staff have our 52 questions for Work Team 4 queued somewhere, now would be the perfect time to bring it forward. And we will go through these. In terms of this group of questions, we have had perhaps not as much time as Rubens and I would like to have seen devoted to looking at these questions, but we are running up against the end time in terms of having our work team have extra input into them. So what Rubens and I want to have out of today's call is a primary lack of disagreement, if not agreement, that these questions, perhaps subject to some minor editorial changes, if you note any in today's activities to be made, are what we will go through with for our 52. While we're going through these questions, I would also like to see whether some of you might wish to have preference for if we're going to discuss any of these questions in greater detail during our gathering in Copenhagen. I briefly saw Don holding the phone, which is probably Terry dialing out to him, so it looks like we should dive into the CC2 and just see how far we get. So you have scrolling, so if you'd like to look at your screen, the first set of questions is to do with internationalized domain names, and there's a reference point there so people looking at these questions can drill down to material. There is four sub-questions that we've allocated into this question number 4.1. The first one is the issue of one character IVNs, which we had, I think, very useful and meaningful discussion in our presentation with Saman the other day. And I think it's a very vital question to maintain as we go out for community consultation. The second question is to do in terms of general guidance or fragmented issues that may be policy work we need to look at in terms of subsequent procedures regarding IDNs. The third is looking specifically at IDN variant TLDs in terms of their method of possible disallowance, any restrictions, and what sort of things do we believe, does the community believe, need to be established before launching any subsequent procedures. And finally, under this particular topic of internationalized domain names, there is the question to the community about should the process be coordinated and or harmonised with the CCTLDs, recognising that, of course, CCTLD community has already had a fast-tracked IDN for the use of their country names in place relatively successfully for several years. So I've been told by Steve that Don is on audio, so just before we go to Don now, I just wanted to see if we can finish 4.1. So with that, can I ask, is there anyone who wishes to make commentary, editorial suggestions, or raise any points on our question 4.1 for CC2 as is outlined in the document in front of you?
Can anybody hear me?
We can hear you, Ruben. Delighted to hear you, my dear.
Hello, all.
Okay, I'm not seeing a mass of people going, I object to 4.1.2 being in. So let's assume that we're all happy to agree that that question 4.1 is as writ. And we will now put a pin in that piece of work. We'll come back to that later. And as Don has been able to join us, if staff could now load back the presentation, I think it's time for us to hand over to you, Don, and to welcome you and thank you very much for taking some of your valuable time to bring us up to speed to with universal acceptance. I know an awful lot has been done with UA in the last little while, and recent blog post and email outlines a number of important key events that have been affected or documents published in the last 12 to 18 months. So, Don, over to you, and if you don't mind, just get you to test your audio, and I'm happy to help you manage a queue. If you just let us know if you would like to take questions during or at the end of your presentation. Over to you, Don.
Thanks very much, Cheryl. So I'm happy to take questions at any time. Hopefully there's some slides, and the first slide is just hello. So universal acceptance, there's two bits to it. So there's the IDNs and new domain names, and there's email. So let me just talk about the two. So universal acceptance is that domain names, including new top-level domain names, including new top-level gTLDs, IDN gTLDs, and also IDNs at the second level, those have been around for a while now, in some places for quite a while. And what's happening is that the software developers are not keeping pace with the standards. So the standards were revised maybe 10 years ago, and people generally have not bothered to keep their systems up to date. So universal acceptance, and related to that is EAI. So EAI is E stands for Email Address Internationalization, and it is about email addresses that are not in ASCII. So this could be IDN domain names, or it could be mailbox names at the in Unicode. So there's two bits to an email address. There's the mailbox and there's the domain name. So either one could be in non-ASCII characters. So we're looking at these two issues, universal acceptance and EAI. And it's basically a software issue. It's not an internet issue. It's not a DNS issue. It's not really a registry or registrar issue, though registries and registrars should make sure that their systems are UA ready. But it's basically a software issue. So in the rest of the deck is much more detail of stuff that we've published in some of our documentation, but it's just an easy place to read. So I hope that gives you some sense of UA, and my preference is really to answer questions as to why you think it might have something to do with the next round of new top-level domains.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Don. And if we'd like to open a queue for discussion and or questions, of course, comments are also welcome. Just to start off, Don, if I may, while people are getting ready to put their hands up or type in their questions into chat, I've always felt that within the guidebook it would be wise to use a leverage point to see that the requirement for UA and indeed EAI is well understood by applicants, and that they perhaps could be encouraged, if not required, to make a commitment to be compliant to best practice. Is that the type of thing that consumer advocates like me are just going too far on, or is that the type of thing the subsequent research working group should be seriously discussing and considering? Don?
Yeah, so thanks, Cheryl. I think that would be something that you could include in the guidebook. The number of transactions that happen with registries and registrars from the consumers is really pretty small, and I'd much rather have so I don't think it's a big deal for the internet industry. We're much more interested in the banking industry and the transport industry and e-commerce and social media folks to all become UA ready. Having said that, we do have a project to encourage what I call the internet industry, within the garden, to make sure that they are UA ready. And we're working with ECO and the I2 Coalition and the DNA to develop a document that they can give to their members to help accelerate their adoption of universal acceptance. But in terms of where it fits in the guidebook, I think it would be under a good practice, possibly. If you're going to include it at all, a good practice, but I wouldn't put it as a required practice.
Thank you, Don. Cheryl, for the record, it sounds to me like you're making our job very easy, and I certainly appreciate that. Ruben, over to you.
Thanks, Cheryl. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm clear.
I think it's good day in the time zone you are. So good day for you. Good morning. I have a question that's not based on my personal belief, but that's something that I heard along ICANN corridors for a while. That for some people believe that contracted parties in general should be warning possible registrants of universal acceptance issues. So they should say, hey, oh, you are trying to register an IDN TLD or simply a new DTLD with length different than 3 letters, and those parties should have been warning them. Do you share that belief, or do you think that is counterproductive?
So that's a very interesting question and probably outside of my space. But what I can tell you what we're seeing in the real world. And we're seeing, so when we do our measures of acceptance of a variety of domain names, email addresses, particularly in various websites, we get pretty high acceptance rate for new domain names and new TLDs that are short. But then as the name gets longer, the acceptance gets lower. And then when we introduce IDNs, it gets lower still. And when we introduce EAI, that is a Unicode at IDN.IDN, it gets really low. And then when we try Arabic.Arabic at Arabic.Arabic, it becomes very, very low indeed. I don't know that people should, so I wouldn't say that people should be warned, but that would be my perception. You guys might have a different view. I hope that we'll make good progress in getting more and more applications UA ready as we reach out to more and more developers and CIOs to let them know that the issue exists. But I don't, do you put a warning label on it? If you're going to do that, you would do it for all new TLDs or anything other than .com, really. So we're seeing, we saw early on that some new CC TLDs were also rejected. And, in fact, in New Zealand, when they opened up the second level, a number of second level .nz names were rejected initially until people learned about it. Does that help answer that question?
Rubens, we can see your microphone, but we're not hearing you. Just check if you're muted or if you've lost your connection quality.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
We hear you now. Go ahead. Okay, sure for the record again. I see another hand up for our farm, please. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Kwok. I've just got a broad question here. When we talk about putting universal acceptance in the application guidebook, but I don't see how it applies to the next round of applying. Universal of IDNs being a problem where it either stops a prospective registry operator to request an IDN TLD, for example, or even have IDNs in their TLD because the use of their TLD won't be great. We're talking about the email systems and things like that. So I'm just trying to understand here how does universal acceptance within the application guidebook, how does that help more, or how does it help improve the process?
Don, if you wanted to respond.
Yeah, I don't know. So it's Don here. I don't know how to respond to that because I don't know how it would. I think three operators might want to know about it, or maybe there's a paragraph that says experience since the 2001 release of new GTLDs has found that not all applications are able to accept them, and that applicants should be aware of that. But again, this has been an issue since 2001 that I know of, and you know, some of the operators from 2001 still see the occasional rejection of their domains.
Thanks, Don. I just wanted to read to the record what Rubens has put into chat, which is the text from the current applicant guidebook, which states the following. Applicants must further demonstrate that they have made reasonable efforts to ensure that the encoded IDN string does not cause any rendering or operational problems. And then he goes on to say that the follow-up example is of a tone higher than you are mentioning mixed scripts. So I take it from that then, Rubens, that possibly a small anecdote or example in that part of the applicant guidebook which at least alerts prospective registrants to a particular IDN GTLD, that UA is a potential issue, and perhaps even just a link to documentation within the ICANN world as to what they can find out about it might more than suffice. Is if you could type and or try your actual audio, that would be good to have your reaction on that. Don, I noticed your microphone light up there. Do you want to make a comment on that as well?
So, Cheryl, it's not just IDNs that are having UA problems. So we're seeing UA issues in ASCII TLDs. And we're seeing UA issues in short ASCII TLDs as well as long ASCII TLDs. So the issue around UA is how up to date have developers done their validation routines, for example. And if their validation routines are 20 years old, which is quite possible, then they will miss out on .info and .museum and .arrow and .blackfriday and .xyz and so forth. So it's not just an IDN issue, it's people running very old validation routines.
Thank you, Don, and thank you for shaking my head out of IDN mode quite appropriately and reminding us all that it's a more generic issue. Perhaps it is germane for this work team to think of it then under its technical issues remit and perhaps think of some small but effective input that we may be able to propose to at least assist or raise awareness. Croc, I see you again. Go ahead.
Thanks, Don. That's a great point that you brought up, because universal acceptance, we see issues with even ASCII IDNs, but with what Rubens put in the chat comment, applicants must further demonstrate that they made reasonable efforts to ensure that the encoded IDN string does not cause any rendering or operational problems. What can a applicant do though? Because with IDNs, with the ICANN contract, it's subject to the IDN RFCs, which talk about formatting and what kind of characters can go with what characters and things like that, and also things subject to language tables that can be used and verification of those tables to make sure that they're okay. And at the same time, we have another working group, the LGR group as well, to help define that as well. So a lot of this kind of stuff is out of the applicant's hands, and I guess what they're sold on is the thought of, hey, I can have an IDN TLD, or if not an IDN TLD, an ASCII TLD that has offering of RDM.ASCII. So just with that kind of stuff, I'm still not clear on what that example, for example, that Ruben's put. What can a registry operator do with regards to UA just to put in the applicant guidebook to make it work? Because all the efforts are, like what Dom said, is outside of are more to do with operators of systems and computer applications, software, things that uses domains to render a response.
Thanks for that, Philip. It's Charlie here off the record again. Ruben, do you want to test your audio and see if you can respond on the audio part of our channel at the moment?
Let's give it a try. Can people hear me?
Indeed. Go ahead, Ruben.
Thank you. I also collected from the same team, Universal Acceptance team, what ended up being part of the register agreement, which is one of the covenants with a technical feasibility of string. YOICon has encouraged and will continue to encourage universal acceptance of all top-level domain strings across the Internet. Certain top-level domain strings may encounter difficulty in acceptance by ISPs and web hosters and or validation by web applications. Register operator shall be responsible for ensuring to its satisfaction that the technical feasibility of TLD string prior to entering this agreement. So this is much more like a waiver. I say, hey, register operator, you need to check that, which is fine for a contract with ICANN, but it at least has, it has one advantage compared to the guidebook version, that it does not restrict itself to IDNs. It actually encompasses all universal acceptance, but it's still only a waiver saying, oh, you are responsible. It's not something that has any type of requirement of doing something else. It's more something like, I cannot be sued because a TLD is not 100% acceptance. So the question here for Don and Kofa and others is whether does it still hold as best model, and let's do this and work on the other hand on coordination activities, which for me is fine, just to check out the everyone in the community is agreeing with that.
Thanks, Ruben. Charlotte, that's a new hand, I think. Back to you. If that's a new hand, you're recognized, but we're not hearing anything from you. So, Terry, we can see his microphone trying to work. Is there anything you can do to assist?
Certainly, Cheryl. I'll work with Quack on that.
Thanks for that. What I might suggest, Ruben, is that we, just being aware of the time, think about after Quack's last next intervention, wrapping this up and seeing if we can perhaps contemplate what we will do on the matter of UA. And note that, of course, we do have a question in CC2 proposals regarding UA, and that we will be getting some feedback from community on this topic as well. Oh, can we hear you now?
Hello? Can you hear me now?
Go ahead. Yes, we can. Go for it.
Yes, sorry. I have no idea what's going on with my... My phone's not working properly, so I've only got my laptop to rely on. Whilst I was trying to figure out my audio issues, what was the question posed? Sorry, I got distracted with the technology.
Ruben, you didn't post a particular question just across, did you? You were making a general statement, I thought.
Yes, but let me try summarizing that. I just mentioned what is written in the agreement, which is basically a waiver. So new GTLD registries don't sue ICANN, that if they have universal acceptance issues that say, you have to live with that and to contemplate that beforehand, before entering the agreement. And the general question was that, is that anything that we should change in that, or just leave that as being a waiver, being a warning from ICANN to registries, and then move on with life?
Yeah, so just on that, I guess. Sorry. I'll start talking again. So thanks for pointing out that, Ruben. I guess that has to be in there, only because so registry operators that have a TLD that's not universally accepted can't get angry about ICANN because systems outside of ICANN can't support their TLD, which creates a bad user experience for their registrar, and therefore the popularity of the TLD. Do we need to put anything else in there? I think. If it's only for that, then I think that short statement is fine. I'm not sure we need to put anything else in there, or if anything else more regarding universal acceptance needs to put in there, especially advising the registry operator to go and do more or ensure that universal acceptance is going to be supported by their TLD. So that's not really a question, it's just sort of mine.
Ruben, did you want to respond before we wrap up, because we need to wrap up?
Nope, I'm fine. I
saw your microphone flash on, Ruben. Sorry, that's why I was assuming you wanted to say something. Sure, for the record. So other than obviously the oversight where we seem to have been within the applicant guidebook talking about universal acceptance uniquely with IDMs, we probably should make sure that there is, as Don outlined, all of the other parts, non-IDM string issues need to be picked up as well, including the short ASCII ones. So we will make an effort to put some text together for consideration, which will not be happening now until, I suspect, certainly after Copenhagen, but perhaps while we're waiting for the responses to the CC2 questions to come back. With that, I think it's probably time for us to thank Don very much for making the effort to bring us up to speed today, and I think to take a little concern away from anyone on this particular work team who felt there was some driving need to do something significant about universal acceptance in subsequent procedures and future applicant guidebook, where in fact a light touch, barely more than a little editorial changing on what is already in existence is probably all that is required. But thank you very much, Don, and we look forward to seeing the continuing work of the Universal Acceptance Issues Group. And if you would like to stay with us, you're welcome, and if you'd like to get back to your real afternoon in New Zealand, you're more than welcome to drop off the call as well. Thanks very much. Our staff, if we can bring back up the CC2 questions again. And with 15 minutes left on the clock for our call, let's see if we can get through the remainder of these as promptly as we did with our section 4.1. With section 4.2, we have a single question relating to universal acceptance. That's a nice segue from the presentation we've had. And that is a question to the community which says, do you see any universal acceptance issues that would warrant policy development work, noting that there is extensive coordination work already being done under the Universal Acceptance Steering Group? That opens the door for something we haven't thought about to be raised to our attention, but it is not, I think, spending more time than is required on the topic of universal acceptance. So anyone who wishes to make a statement, make an editorial comment, suggest any changes to that question. Excellent. Let's move on then to 4.3, which is all to do with application evaluation. The first section is technical evaluation, and I just want to ask if Rubens, Rubens, are you happy for me to continue to push through these questions in this manner? Okay, yep, sounds like he is. So I'm going to keep control of the helm, but anytime you want to wrestle it back from me, please just do so. Okay, so 4.3, application evaluation. We have subsections within that, technical evaluation and financial evaluation. In the technical evaluation part, we have, again, a couple of specific questions that have been outlined, and in fact I think it's something that the community should have, we should have a reasonable expectation of the community that they should be able to respond to that. The first one, 4.3.1.1, is do you believe that technical capability should be demonstrated at application time or be demonstrated at or just before contract signing time? And I'm not going to look into my crystal ball and try and predict what community is going to say on that, but I am going to be very interested to see the answers and perhaps the variety of responses we may get to that question. Let's move on to the next one, which is, do you believe that technical evaluation should be done per application, per cluster of similar technical infrastructure of a single applicant entity group, or per cluster of similar infrastructure among all applicants in a procedure, e.g. consolidating as much as possible? And again, this is a question well worth asking in my very biased view, and I'm certainly going to be very interested to see what community answer comes in on that. There are real benefits to some of the consolidation aspects that have been discussed, and I think hearing what the community wishes to say on that is very important indeed. And of course that then leads us to the following question, which of course is making an assumption that we may hear from the community that consolidation is indeed desirable. So it goes on to say, if consolidated, should the aggregate requirements of applied for TLDs and currently operated TLDs be taken in consideration for evaluation? And again, I think this is a very important question for us to tease out community opinion. The next section is financial evaluation, but what I might do is hold here and just see if there's anybody who wishes to make any comments, changes, editorial suggestions, etc., on the technical evaluation aspect. In other words, 4.3.1. Okay, sounds like we've got the recipe right on that. So let's move to the financial evaluation part, which is 4.3.2. So 4.3.2 starts off with a statement and then asks some questions relating to that. But let's look at the statement. first of all, most in the community can agree that financial stability of a GTLD operator is necessary to ensure the security, stability and resiliency of the internet. Experiences from the 2012 round, as it pertains to the financial evaluations, questions 45 to 50 in brackets, the quantity of clarifying questions, lack of insight into the appropriateness and rationale of a company's financial plan, and lack of flexibility in dealing with different types, entity types and structures have shown many inefficiencies in the application process. So that is the problem statement. Then from that problem statement, the following questions are asked. Having financial safeguards in place, is it necessary for ICAM to seek detailed financial information as it pertains to an applicant's proposed business model, projected revenue, and operating expenses? This is a question that I have heard discussed in other fora, and I think we will find the responses of the community to that question very illuminating indeed. It goes on to have then a follow-up question, which is, can financial capability be demonstrated with less detail? Which details or levels of detail are unnecessary? That in itself is a detailed question and probably relies on the community having a relatively deep understanding of how much detail was being required of the applicants. So we might need to discuss and socialise that particular issue to assist some parts of the community to have a better understanding. But if not, we can just let it by. Then goes on to 4.3.2.3 and talks about the prior round. In the prior round, detailed business plans were provided. Yet it is unclear how they have been used or the benefits they have provided. Do you believe that there was a benefit to this disclosure? What benefit would you expect from registries providing this information? And how can this disclosure be made more beneficial? How should changes in business plans during the application process be handled? So it's a multi-pronged question there. And again, it's one that I believe the community answers will be quite illuminating. And then talk about brands and geographic applications. So it goes on to ask the next question. For brands and geographic applications supported by governments, is an understanding and submission of their business model necessary? If not, what analogous information should be submitted? One of the points made in the discussion about the relative effectiveness of getting this degree of disclosure that certainly I've heard has been, yes, but when you've got a brand, it is a unique set of circumstances in terms of business modelling, and when you've got geographic applications supported by governments, the whole concept of financial viability and stability is a different question than you would have in some other issues. So that's what we're trying to tease out there. We then have just three more sections to this financial evaluation. And this one's a little lengthy, so forgive me. It seems that it's not within ICAM's direct mission and scope to, in inverted commas, promote or, in inverted commas, market GTLD expansion. Thus, is it within ICAM's mission to evaluate details of a proposed business model if financial capability is sufficiently demonstrated? Is the proposed business model merely meant to demonstrate the financial capability, or does it have other purposes? Should ICAM replace the financial model with a checkbox that they have sufficient capabilities to support their application and continuing operation of the registry? What additional information or documentation should be supplied, if any, to support the checking of the box? And how should any of this be reflected in the registry agreement? What penalty, if any, should be put in place if the financial capabilities are not truthfully represented in the application? Again, a multi-pronged question, but one that I think people who have experience within previous rounds will have deeply held beliefs on, and that will be interesting to see whether that is at variance with other community reactions to this question. The next one is, do you believe that financial capability should be demonstrated at application time, or could it be demonstrated at or just before contract signing time, or should it be demonstrated at both times? That, to me, is one that we could possibly make an editorial change on, and I'm just going to pause here to draw your attention back, if I can get my screen to go back, to the question asked earlier, where we had the technical capability being demonstrated at application time or just or before contract signing time. The duplication is important, but what we don't do with the technical capability is ask should it be done at both times. So you may want to have consider parity between those two, what I would see as mirror images of questions in both the technical and the financial. But I'm not going to die in a ditch over that. It just strikes me as the demonstrators at both times could perhaps be in both of those questions. And then finally, under financial, do you believe that financial evaluation should be done per application or per possible registry family, assuming all applied for strings are one? With that, that closes off the questions for community on financial evaluation, and I want to ask you all now very, very briefly, do any of you have an overwhelming urge to bring edits or comments on that section? And if not, I'm going to push us to finish the next part of our questioning before we close off the call. I'll remind us that we did start the call some 6 minutes after our start time, so with your indulgence, I may request that we push this call a few minutes after the hour so that we can close off this piece of work. We then have general questions, which is 4.3.3, and the single question in this subset is, what suggestions do you have for improving the application evaluation process that you would like the community to consider? It's a grab bag opportunity there, and one that could shake out some interesting issues. Moving on to the second last topic on our questions, which is 4.4, name collision, with again the wiki page link provided. The first question, 4.4.1, is what general guidance for namespace collisions would you like the community to consider for subsequent procedures and why? The next one, were there non-applied for strings that would fall into a high-risk category that you would suggest not be allowed in subsequent, I'm assuming it means rounds as opposed to procedures, but anyway, it says subsequent procedures. If yes, which ones and why? Should a name collision-based evaluation be incorporated into the process for subsequent procedures? At what data sources could or should be used for analysing namespace collisions for subsequent procedures? And with that, again, a multi-pronged question, and I would certainly be looking forward to the response to that question that will come out of, I hope, the ESAC. On to 4.3, based on data from the first round, can the controlled interruption period be reduced in future rounds? 4.4.4, should any measure be suggested or requested from TLDs that already ended or will end their emergency readiness after 2 years of delegation? Are any measures needed for GTLDs delegated prior to the 2012 round? And again, that's one that I'll be particularly interested to see the response from EFSAC. opening that one up before we do our final and short piece for any comments, edits, or suggestions. I love silence when it comes to this type of consensus building. Let's move to our final piece, which is 4.5, security and stability, again with the wiki page link provided. Two questions here. The first one is, considering that, different from the 2012 round, we now have top-level label generation rules available for most, if not all, scripts and languages, does the per-label security and stability review still make sense? Really interesting question. The next one is, considering the already published CDAR study and comments to that study, do you have any comments regarding root zone scaling? And with that, I'm going to ask for any comments or questions for the last section, and I see Avery. Avery, go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick comment, and I didn't get my hand up quick enough for 4.4.4. One of the things that I'm going to want to look into is whether that one is in scope for this PDP, because it's asking not about future but about past. So I want to talk to Jeff and others, and I'll probably bring that issue up again in plenary. Just wanted to let folks know. Thanks.
Thanks for that, Avery. Cheryl, for the record, and I, for one, am perfectly happy to have that particular question culled. This does stand out a little bit to me as well. I'm also keen for us to have a small enough set of questions in the CC2 papers that go out that the community has the energy and the inclination to respond to in a full, frank and fearless way. So dropping the number of total questions and sub-questions is not a bad idea as far as I'm concerned. That's just my own bias. So it'd be interesting to see what the plenary thinks about that. Rubens, do you have anything else you want to say now before we do a bit of a wrap-up on today's agenda? Seeing Rubens putting things in chat. Rubens, do you have audio but stability at the moment? Yes, we can. Go ahead, Rubens.
Hi, Sharon. I won't even repeat what was already put in the chat. Just comment that the question of mirroring financial and the technical questions, we have take a look at technical evaluation was actually two-pronged already because it was an evaluation and then a pre-delegation test. So with technical capabilities, some of those technical capabilities could be actually verified, different from the financials. But I think we should possibly try merging that and making that more homogeneous. We can make that fully homogeneous because there is already a difference, but we can work on that. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Ruben. Just tidying up on that is probably merited. But subject to that small toilet, to the text you all have in front of you, I think what we do is we put out to the list that, and perhaps after that edit and update you just outlined, Ruben, if you want to own that, that update, that would be good, that we put this back to our list for the next 24 to 36 hours for anyone to comment on, basically make it as an advisory. Our meeting reviewed these questions, minor adjustments were made. We note one question will go to plenary and may be considered for removal from this set. And that if you have any objections, let us know, insert time, because this has just got to go out now and become part of the plenary discussion. As Avery rightfully pointed out, yes, it is going to be typed lines. Julie, I'm well aware that we're 5 minutes over, and as I said, at the end of the hour, we started 7 minutes late, so I'm not feeling guilty over that. I'm now calling, is there any other business, which I'm assuming not? And in the absence of any other business, and recognising that we've had a guest that we greatly appreciated their time, we have staff who were on the call on time, and I appreciate that. I think we've at least managed to progress through our CC2 questions, which is an important piece of work, and taking it perilously close to an hour's worth of work, but an hour and 7 minutes worth of your time. I want to thank you one and all and call this meeting to an end. Bye for now.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.